Hi, everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. It is the very end of November 23rd, 2020, the very beginning of the seventh day of Cheshvan, 5781. And it's been, I'm sure for all of you also, a busy week since I was last on. But I'm very honored to have on tonight Dr. Norma Frankel from the University of Haifa, who is an archaeologist who I've run into and spoken to over the years at different events and different tours that we've taken to learn new things, and of course heard her lecture. But the reason that I specifically asked her to come on the show this week is because I think a small step forward perhaps was taken, or at least we got out of the very many steps backwards that we were going to. Some of you might have been fortunate enough to visit what was the capital of the state of Israel, and I'm talking about the original state of Israel when there was a Judah and an Israel, known as Sebastia, known as Shomron, known as Samaria. We'll talk about the different names in a minute. And for the last couple of decades, it's been very, very difficult to get there. Under the Oslo Accords, Israel made, well, the road was like kind of in the hands of the Palestinian Authority, even though the site wasn't exactly. And we needed to go there only with army permission and on specific days. And it just made it very ludicrous and very difficult for people to go, not to mention the fact that, of course, that it was being looted and destroyed all the time. The last time I was there, I guided a group there last summer, summer of 2019. And it's really an absolutely incredible site. So Dr. Franklin, thank you so much for joining us today on Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Thank you very much for the introduction, Eve.
And the reason that I asked Dr. Franklin is because she is one of the experts on this site. And the good news is that because of the very bad news of the Palestinian Authority actually making it a heritage site of theirs, and as far as we know, they have nothing absolutely to do with this place historically whatsoever, with the aid of the Belgian government, it was finally too much, even for the very patient Israelis. And so Midreshet Shomron, which is an organization that takes upon itself to tour the Shomron, to take groups out, to learn about the different archaeological sites and hiking trails in the Shomron, has now set up that every Wednesday there will be constant tours going in and out of this site. And so while Dr. Franklin isn't involved with Midreshet Shomron, she is certainly very involved with this site. And this is an opportunity to really talk about a place. Well, what do you think, Dr. Franklin? This is one of the most important archaeological sites in the country.
Well, I love it. What can I say? It makes my heart glow every time I go there. It has a certain magic about it. And I'm very happy that if tourism, local tourism from Israel is going there, because up till now, it's really been off the map for tourists, except for perhaps a small percentage of Catholic tourists from overseas, usually Italians, because of the involvement with John the Baptist, which is part of the story.
It's a mm-hmm. nice story. So maybe tell my listeners, my watchers, we're also taping this, if you happen to be watching YouTube, everything of course is on Zoom these days. Give my listeners a little bit of your background. How did you become really one of Israel's experts on this site? And judging by your accent, you're probably not a native born Israeli. Like myself.
No, my British English.
The Queen's English, yes.
Despite being in Israel for nearly 50 years.
Some things never go. But where did you get your PhD in archaeology?
From Tel Aviv University. Now I'm attached to Haifa University. So if you want to know why Samaria, why this site spoke to me, it's because of the Omrite dynasty, which is Omri, his son Ahab, daughter-in-law Jezebel, one of the most, I think, most interesting dynasties in the ancient Israel. It's all to do with the 9th century BCE. And also because I was excavating a very large excavation under the aegis of Tel Aviv University. I was from 1992. I was one of the founder members of the expedition there. And what interested me personally there was the 9th century and during the kingdom under Omri. And so for my PhD, I chose to take these two sites, the capital city that was founded by Omri, didn't exist before, and Megiddo, which is this multi-layered site that started off way back in 5,000 years or 3,000 years before Omri was fought of, say, and collate them and see what have they got in common. And in order to do that, well, Megiddo was easy. I was excavating there and easy access. Samaria, I say Samaria, I'll mention why in a minute. Samaria, the capital of the Kingdom of Israel, was much more difficult. It had been excavated many years ago. And I had to excavate in the archives, not physically. Mm-hmm. And the archives that I excavated basically were in Harvard, in the what was called the Semitic Museum. They've just changed their name, and I forgot what they've changed it to, but it's in Harvard, in Cambridge, in the whole complex there. Mm-hmm. And I was sat there in the basement, going excavating in the basement. Nowadays, it would be much easier for me because nearly all of their notebooks, I don't know why there's a few missing, are all online. And anybody can read them, and they're great fun. They're handwritten, a little bit difficult going. So if I'd have done it today, it would have been a lot easier. But that was my PhD, was doing this comparison between these two great cities during the time of the Omri dynasty. So Omri,
now, Jezebel. Many of my listeners know that there is a lot of controversy when it comes to biblical history, and there's people pulling this way and people pulling that way.
Yeah.
The main issues, if I'm not mistaken, reside in the 10th century, in what happens like before 900.
Yes.
Are we pretty much from minus 854 or something like that? Pretty much the Bible and archaeology pretty much goes in lockstep. We have the proofs for Ahab, etc.
Well, listen, we let's put it this way. It's a lot easier.
Yeah.
10th century is a problem because we don't have any external texts. And external texts outside, when I say that, it's outside the Bible, really help us understand things. And in the 9th century, we have our first mention of the kings of Israel. We have a text which was found in Moab that's called the Meshech Stele by the king of Moab, which today is in southern Jordan, about the problems he had with Omri, the king of Israel. We have mention of Ahab, his son, in a text, in an Assyrian text, which was found today in southern Syria, but in Assyrian, right? Not Syrian.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly, wow, we've got historical, archaeological, they exist, we know them. And this is the problem, that when we don't have something outside of the Bible to correlate, to hang our archaeology and our biblical text on, then it's very difficult. The 9th century, it's much easier, and onwards from the 9th century, of course.
So give us a little bit of the history for those who don't understand. So Omri starts this place as a capital city. And for those who are not familiar with the layout of the land of Israel, as comparison, let's say, to Megiddo, it's so clear when you come to Israel why Megiddo is going to be a strategic site always. All right. It's at the edges of the Jezreel Valley, which is an incredibly fertile place. It's at the opening to really one of the only gorges that lead from the valley to the coast to control the road and the trade routes.
Yes, it's on the Megiddo, easy, right? It's on the main international highway, the Romans called the Via Maris, or in Bible, the Way of the Sea.
Right.
So there's a change of dynasty. The Northern Kingdom of Israel was, as far as we understand it from the Bible, and I think obviously in reality as well, was less stable than the much smaller Kingdom of Judah. The winner writes history. So in Judah, we see there's sort of a certain stability there, father to son, father to son. Things are more complicated in the Northern Kingdom. And we have Omri taking the throne. And up until that time, from what we only know from the Bible, we don't know it from any other external texts, the elders of Israel were in Shechem, biblical Shechem, Shechem, however you want to pronounce it.
Nablus in English.
Little town in the middle of modern day Nablus. And then the first capital city was a place called Tirzah. And Tirzah is right down, actually overlooks the Jordan Valley. And I've been to Tirzah. It's not an easy place to get to. It's in the under the aegis of the Palestinian right. Authority. It's been excavated, but it's like wild. And wild dogs and all the rest of it running around. When you were there, you think, this is a crazy place to have as a capital city of the Kingdom of Israel. It's really out of it. It's really, you're practically in Jordan. You're in, practically in the Jordan River. That's the sort of the feel of it. It's so much to the east. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand Ahab decides to found his own capital.
Omri or Ahab?
Oh, sorry. Omri. Ooh, you caught me up. Omri. He decides to found his own capital, and he buys, we get this story in the Bible, this wonderful story. He buys a plot of land, and we're told how much it costs. It's a hill, actually, and he buys it from a man called Shemer. Now, it's great because actually we don't have a town or a city on this hill before Omri gets there. We do have, and that's according to archaeology, farmland. It's definitely been, there's all sorts of clues that the place was agriculturally really rich. And we see storage, we see oil presses, we see wine presses, we see things which were very, very important. And I used to sometimes say Omri was an oil man, you know, not a Texan, but he was a Sumerian oil man, because this was huge money. This was revenue. Your kingdom needed oil, and it also needed wine. And I'll explain mm-hmm. that later. And so he buys this piece of land, and he builds the first city there. And it's very exciting because you can actually see it. The early archaeologists who excavated there, which was the University of Harvard, in 1909, 1910, they actually could define that earliest city quite easily. They had many more problems with the later cities because, you know, everything gets one on top of another. But the earliest city was really sitting on the bedrock of the hill, and they shaped the bedrock. They actually cut an artificial cliff on the top of the hill, 4 meters high, 4 meters, if you want me to translate that.
No, I think we're good.
Multiply it by three.
12 right? feet, something like that. Feet. Right.
Approximately. And on top of that, they built the palace. So I find that amazing that in the ancient times, you could be walking along in the city and suddenly you came up against this huge cliff, and you're already high up, you're on top of a hill. Mm-hmm. And on top of that huge cliff, wow, is the palace.
An imposing palace.
Imposing yeah. is just, yes, beyond measure, incredible. Mm-hmm. Today, there's a little bit of that palace.
Yeah, you can make it
but
out.
It's exciting. You can see it. You can touch it. You can stand on that bedrock platform and know you're standing where the kings of Israel stood. Mm-hmm. And even more exciting, where did the king get buried? He wasn't buried anywhere. And he was allowed, a king was the only person allowed to be buried in the city. Everybody else had to be buried outside of the city, and not just anywhere within the city. And it says this in the Bible very clearly, in his home. And this huge cliff that was artificially shaped and cut has at least two, because I had the pleasure of identifying them, two tunnels cut into the cliff that lead to two burial chambers.
Wow.
And so we know that we're looking at the burial chambers of the kings of Israel. And there's little technical reasons why I believe one of them actually belongs to Omri, because they had to cut that one before they built the palace. Wow. So, yes. Is this exciting? Yes. Super. I love
it. Yeah, super exciting. Yeah. You know, you mentioned Tirza. So for those of my listeners who are biblically oriented, that name should ring a bell. One of the five daughters of Tzlofchad, the girls from the tribe of Menashe who have no brothers, and beseech Moshe Rabbeinu himself, Moses himself, well, but if all the inheritance is going to go to the men, but we want a piece of the land of Israel too. And he doesn't even know what to do. He kicks it upstairs to the ultimate lawyer in the sky, right, to God himself, who says, wow, these girls really love the land, and they can, as long as they don't marry outside the tribe so that the land stays within the tribe, they can have it. And what is so exciting, when I studied about the Harvard expedition, is that they found on Ostraka, if I'm not mistaken, the names of these girls, meaning the family lots, if you will, the family homesteads of Menashe, of that area, inside the palace area, inside Shomron, Samaria, inside that town, dating probably to what, 500 years or so after we come into the land? Hundreds of years.
Those dockets that they found with these amazing names, they date to the 8th century. They're about 100 years after Omri.
Right, but meaning that a few hundred years after we've come into the land, these families are still going by the names of the foremothers, if you will, who received that inheritance. And you mentioned oil and wine. So what would these dockets have been? And what is the king getting from the countryside that someone would sign a chit for, or legal document at that time? So what is happening in terms of the material culture and the day-to-day life that the Bible doesn't necessarily speak about, because it's not a history book and it is giving us the message and the main story. But what do you uncover as an archaeologist? And this is one example that gives you a glimpse into how the king is actually ruling his subjects on a day-to-day basis and how he himself is amassing no small amount of wealth.
Yes, well, every king wants wealth. I mean, this is the nature of the game. You know, who needs it? You got to have money. No, but you, and I think we find this. Look, modern day taxes, right? I mean, we pay our taxes. The state always creams off something and then hopefully uses it for the common good and not just for themselves. And it uses it to pay the army. And every kingdom had an army, not necessarily a standing army, but people were on their guard. There was no end of enemies in ancient times. And we see that in the Bible, that either this one or that one, there was always something going on. And so, yes, you have to have some sort of state organization, whether it's giving tithes to a temple or to the priests. And people somewhere up at the top, nothing changes, are amassing wealth taken from the people, hopefully for the common good. And oil is of extreme importance, because think of the electricity company today. How do you turn on your light? How do you turn on your computer? It's electricity. And you're paying for that, and you're paying taxes for that. Well, in the old days, how did they turn on the light? They lit an oil lamp. That was it. You know, the oil was essential for many different tasks. So that was, it was essential also. They would eat the oil, they would use it. No one ate olives. No one had nice little pickled olives with the
paper in it. martini, for dinner, right.
Yeah. And other oils we're discovering as well, but olive oil was, you know.
And for soap, right, for other uses, they still do that.
No soap as such, but yes, you wash you put oil on, and wine. And wine was extremely important. It's because you really couldn't always drink the water.
Right.
And if you had and the wine was not necessarily, we're told in the Bible, it goes on about the first pressing, the tirash, and this, that, and the other. There's obviously different levels of wine, some better, some worse. Today we'd say, you know, there's a Grand Cru, or there's something that tastes like vinegar. But you actually needed it to purify your water. So to drink plain straight water, you would risking being ill many times, and you would put wine in it, mm-hmm. and then you would drink it.
So I'm going to bet that the king got the best.
Oh, the king definitely got
right. Literally the cream of everybody's crop. And that's what we're seeing on those documents is essentially the paying their taxes or somehow giving whatever they need to give to the king.
There's some state organization going on there. And also if you have an army, one of the most important rations for your army was giving them wine.
Mm-hmm.
Wine for your palace members and wine for your army. Your army could not go out on a campaign without wine. This wasn't to give them bravery. It was to make sure they didn't get sick from drinking the local water.
Bad water. Hmm. Yeah. Fascinating.
So what else did you discover
there?
All sorts of other things.
Right.
Connected to Samaria, but there were many things connected to Samaria.
There's another biblical story that pops to mind that I'm sure people are aware of. You mentioned Ahab, Omri's son. He and Jezebel, not necessarily seen as a power couple in the Bible, but not for the right reasons. And of course, she comes to a terrible end and he is killed in battle. I hope you all know your Bible because it's just a major spoiler alert. But one of the more fascinating stories is actually, I see it as the limits to power, where Ahab wants the vineyard of a man named Naboth because it abuts the palace, and Naboth won't give it to him. And so Jezebel cooks up a whole story about why he is about to betray the king and that then you're punishable by death. And then, of course, they have the very bad luck to have Elijah, the fiery, zealous prophet, as the one who comes knocking on their door to get upset with them. And it's really a very interesting story that I see really is the limits of power, is the limits of eminent domain by the king. He can't just take it. But where do you think that story happened? Because one of the other places that I follow you, that I've seen that you've dug and that you've really made some really fascinating discoveries, is at Jezreel, where there was another palace. And so there's kind of a discussion, if it's a palace, there's kind of a discussion about where this story happens.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
What do you think based on your digs?
I'll tell you. Now, if you'd have asked me more than 10 years ago, I would have said, he had the vineyard at Samaria because he's called Naboth the Jezreelite, which means he's Mr. Naboth who comes from Jezreel. Mm-hmm. And so therefore he must not be living in Jezreel to be having that qualification of where he's from.
Like you'll always be a Brit, even though you've lived in Israel for a long time. And I'll always be an American, even though I've been here for many decades as well. Okay, right. Yes, you're called from where you're from.
So that's what I would have answered 10 years ago. Now, first of all, we found an amazing wine treading area next to the only potential place for growing grapes at Jezreel. I've been excavating at Jezreel together with my co-director, Jenny Ebeling. We've been directing excavations there since 2012. 2012, we did a survey, start excavations, etc. And I suddenly Norma, who said he's got his vineyard in Samaria, finds evidence, perfect location, everything in Jezreel. But you see, we're a team, and on our team, we have a biblical scholar. He's actually French, but lives in Switzerland, Dr. Philippe Guillaume. And Philippe is also he works in agriculture. He's an agriculturalist. He's from farming roots. And he looked at the Naboth story, and he's written about this, and it's fascinating. He said, this wasn't a poor man. You know, we get the impression that Naboth was a real poor guy and he just had his little vineyard and the king takes it. He said, this is a wealthy man. He probably had more than one vineyard. So, but the story that we have about Naboth's vineyard is the story at Jezreel. I buy that now totally. Naboth as a wealthy man might well have been living in Samaria, which is why he has that qualification to his name that he's from Jezreel. But the particular vineyard that's in dispute, I totally believe now it's actually in Jezreel. But this is one wealthy man who was probably part of the court and very likely actually lived in the capital city.
Well, I think what's terrific about this story is that you changed your mind. Not every academic is going to do that. You know, you have some people who just have this idea of what's happened and they don't let the facts or the things that they've dug up interfere with that original opinion. And here you're saying that originally you thought it was in one place, and due to new evidence and some of the other things that you've dug up and some advice from, you know, a scholar who doesn't even live here. Yeah. Then they change. And who knows? And maybe in a few years you'll find something and, you know, change your mind there. So when it comes to come back to Samaria, so you call it Samaria, and let's just talk about the names for a minute, because a lot of people call it Sebastia. I myself am guilty of that, because Samaria is so often used as the terminology for the geographical area, the Shomron, that we know of, and then people get confused and don't think it's just a city.
First of all, the hill in the Bible, the hill was owned by a man called Shemer. Mm-hmm. He sells it to Omri, and they say that Omri named the city Shomron, that's the Hebrew pronunciation, in Shomron, after the man Shemer that he'd bought the hill from. Later on, that name, Shomron in Hebrew, or Samaria in the English pronunciation, becomes not just the name of the capital city, but the whole area of the land. And actually, we know the northern kingdom of Israel was very often called Shomron or Samaria by the neighbors, by the Assyrians. They often called it Samaria. So it's the name Samaria was became interchangeable with the kingdom. But it started off just as the name of the city. And if I give you another example, I've mentioned Jezreel, I dig at Jezreel, and people say, oh yeah, you dig in the Jezreel Valley. And I say, no, I dig in the city of Jezreel, which gave its name to the valley. Mm-hmm. So what came first? We know, it's not the chicken and egg that we're not sure. We know the city came first. And so the city of Omri and Ahab and the kings of Israel, I have to call Samaria in English, or Shomron in Hebrew, because that's what it was called then. Mm-hmm. Now we jump, and it was called that all the way through to the time of Herod the Great, who I don't think was so great, really. Herod the Great. He made himself king. Mm-hmm. I won't go into the whole thing there. And his mentor, his protector, the person who had enabled him to become king, was his actually childhood friend from Rome, who became the Emperor Augustus. And Augustus was a name that the emperor, that he took as his royal name, but when he became emperor.
Changed it from Octavian, yes.
Right. It wasn't, his mummy didn't call him Augustus. Now, we living in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, east of Rome, this whole area was known as the Greek-speaking part. People here did not speak Latin. It was used on a few milestones and official documents. But here, Greek was the language. And the name Augustus in Greek is Sebastos. And Herod totally rebuilt the city of Samaria, the city of Shomron, Samaria, because he knew it was the capital of the kingdom of Israel once upon a time. And Herod liked to justify his kingship. And right on top of the palace of Omri, luckily not all of the palace, he built a huge temple. It's the highest part of the hill, right? On top of that. Mm-hmm. He built a huge temple to his mentor Augustus, who had deified himself. You know, he was a living god now, and the temple was the temple to Sebastos. Mm-hmm. And the name of the city, he renamed the city Sebastos, which became corrupted to Sebastia, and is the village, the local village of the local Palestinian Arabs who live just east of the ancient city is still called Sebastia. So the two names, when I'm talking about the ancient city, I like to use its original name. Mm-hmm. When I'm talking about the city from Herod onwards, I'd like to call it Sebastia or Sebastos, because that's what the name was changed to in memory, mm-hmm. in honor of the Emperor Augustus.
And my understanding is that you could see that temple when you came into the port in Caesarea, Caesar, which is also connected to that Caesar. So he's really lauding his patron in very many ways.
He built two temples, one mm-hmm. in Caesarea and one in Caesarea, there. Both of which are called the Temple to Sebastos and the actual port area of Caesarea, because Caesarea was a big town. It was became eventually the capital of Roman Palestine. You know, mm-hmm. after they had trashed Jerusalem, and the port area was called Sebastos.
Mm-hmm. So this all really connects. So when we go there now, a lot of the remains that we see are actually from this Herodian city, from the beautiful columns on the road.
Well, there's a little bit more. The columns are wonderful. The columned streets, which is actually the Decumanus, the east-west street of the Roman, every Roman city needed an east-west street and a north-south street. North-south street is the Cardo. We only know of a small part of the Cardo has been unearthed, but the Decumanus is wonderful. It's this beautiful romantic column street amongst the olive trees, and it led from the city gates, and it's the same city gates in the Iron Age at the time of, definitely, we would presume from the time of Omri, definitely from the later king of Israel, Jeroboam, who also was responsible for a lot of building there. From the city gates, and it went all the way through to the edge of the end of the Roman city at the far east and quite far east of the Tell, at the ancient Tell, right to the middle of the village of the Palestinian village of Sebastia today. You can still see the other end of it.
Which is doing its best to creep up into the archaeological site every time I go there.
It's been tough actually during the Jordanian rule, because remember mm-hmm. from 48 to 67.
Right.
And the Jordanians did some excavation there as well, a few things. And somehow no one stopped. There's a few houses physically on the Tell. Not too many, not too mm-hmm. many. If we talk about the Roman city, Herod had to have a forum. A Roman city needs a forum. And he had nowhere to put the forum because the city was at the top of a hill like this. Mm-hmm. Then you put the forum. And then to the east, to the west, was this very steep climb up to the city gate. To the east, it was even more problematic because it was this narrow ridge that then led downhill to another valley to the east. So what did Herod do? He built an artificial platform. He was good at that, right? He did that at the Temple Mount.
The Temple Mount as well, right.
Platform, increased the area and created the Roman Forum. So the Roman Forum is still there, and it's used as an occasional football field by the children of Sebastia. It's used as a car park, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not been damaged since it was excavated because during the Jordanian times, they filled it up. They put in about 3 meters of fill to mm-hmm. protect
dirt.
But it's closed off. Visually, we can stand there and know we're standing on the forum, but it's a few meters down.
mm-hmm. And there's a theater there as well.
There's a small theater.
No decent Roman city doesn't have a theater.
It had to have a theater. Absolutely. That was excavated by the Jordanians. They revealed it in its entirety. And it's built like all these, it's an early style, and it's built into the hillside of the ancient city. And it actually leans against, at the very back of it, it leans against the walls of the Greek period city and of the Iron Age, the biblical period city. So you see all these sort of massive walls behind the
it's amazing.
A very complicated site. You've got every period there, some of it more easily explained and others not. But yeah,
it's just such a fascinating site, because the site that obviously you go to with your Tanakh and read about the kings and all these stories, and you can stand there and explain what's going on and where the granaries are that the kings have that are full while the people are starving below, because famine is a constant repetition in the Bible and as punishment, and how the kings deal with it. And then, of course, talk about the Astrakhan and talk about the Herodian city and the Iron One. It's just, it's really such an amazing place. And I feel that as somebody who isn't as intimately acquainted with it as you are and had put so much into it, How do you feel in the last few years, knowing that, A, we weren't getting proper access to it, but more than that, that it was probably being looted and many things were being irreparably damaged?
I've been going regularly for the last 20 years, since 1999, actually. Nothing stops me. I get there.
I don't doubt it. For any of you who are ever going to meet Dr. Norma Franklin, you won't doubt it either. Powerhouse.
So,
but still, you can't be there 24/7, and you're not there with
army.
No,
but I'll tell you, look, there's looting all over the
country.
The West. Yeah, it's because, you know, it's very difficult to stop looting unless you've got a strong force out there.
Right.
Now, actually, the city has not, despite what's been said, it hasn't actually been looted. I have seen holes dug, and I'll explain why it hasn't been looted. It's not from lack of trying. And this is, I'll take you back to the early excavations. And I mentioned Harvard. They dug up there 1908, 1910. That was under the Ottoman Empire.
Before World War I.
The next team that did big, large excavations there was a team known as the Joint. It was basically under a British, mainly a British team, under somebody called John Crowfoot. And John Crowfoot had an assistant. He had to take her because her father was his boss, which has a famous name. You've probably heard of her, Catherine Kenyon. Kenyon was Crowfoot's, one of his assistants. And as I say, he was petrified of her because her father, he was the head of the British Museum, and he was Crowfoot's boss in all of this. And there was also a Jewish element, a pre-state, the Hebrew University. Sue Kennick was his co-director, Eliezer Kennick, who was the father of Yigal Yadin.
Right, the famous archaeologists, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Masada.
So you see how things come together. Yeah. It's really nice. Anyway, they were digging in the 1930s. Now, under the British Mandate. Now, the British Mandate did not change. They enhanced many of the laws that had existed under the Ottoman era. I'm talking about only archaeology. Now, the main law during the Ottoman period, and this affects any excavation you go to that was an early excavation pre-state of Israel, except for Megiddo, which has another story in it. Any excavation had to excavate and then cover up again. Backfill, we call it. So at Samaria, Harvard actually excavated a lot. And they did it in a strip. They would do strip number one, excavate, expose everything, take things away, because to get to the lower layer, and then they'd go and do another strip number two. All the dirt from strip number two, this is after they've taken out the small finds, the goodies, if you like, remove certain architectural items to see what's underneath, they would dump into strip number one.
Oh.
You didn't notice? It's
which you would never do now. Yeah,
no, we don't do it now. It's
totally corrupt the layering and the site.
No, but you excavate, you document, and then you move over. So they never saw everything exposed all at once. So when you go to Samaria, if you only see a very small part of what was actually excavated, it's true for the Harvard excavations, and it's true for the Crowfoot and Kenyon excavations. Kenyon excavated up at the top. Now, I can tell you something even funnier with the Kenyon. She dug this very famous trench that went from one side of the ancient tell to the other. But she couldn't do it in one go, and she couldn't do it in the straight line. Why couldn't you dig a trench in a straight line, you could ask me? It's because every time they uprooted a tree, the excavators, they had to pay a lot of money for that tree to the local farmers. So what they do, they go in a straight line. Oh, there's a tree. Okay, we'll go that way. So she zigzagged across the tell. So, you know, it's the amount of information that you get, the information you do get is, it's problematic. Mm-hmm. Because no one, because she's backfilling as she goes, right?
Right. Right.
So no one's seeing everything open at the same time. And something which is presented as a straight line isn't a straight line. It's zigzagging around trees, so they didn't have to pay the money. Now, I've probably confused everybody.
That's okay. Would you be interested if somebody brought up, and obviously the funding would have to be there, a new excavation in Shomron now, or because of its political sensitivity or the fact that we really can't keep an eye on it? I mean, once you start excavating and uncovering things, other people with some more nefarious ideas can come that night and keep digging and steal some of the things that you hadn't gotten to yet or whatever it is. Do you think it's time for another expedition there?
It's time as far as archaeology is concerned, and for but politically, logistically, politically, it's impossible.
Difficult, yeah.
I had this wonderful idea one day. I remember waking up before I started Jezreel. Hey, I'm going to excavate Somalia. No, Norma, this is just a pipe dream. It's not going to happen in your lifetime. Who knows?
We have to start from somewhere. And I think what Midrashat Shomron is doing now and finally getting it open and people to feel free to come and not worry, I think is a huge step forward in, as you said at the beginning, at least Israelis for now, with all the COVID travel restrictions and we don't have so many foreigners coming in. At least to get Israelis to know the site.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do a little party trick sometimes with Israelis. I say, what was the capital of the Kingdom of Israel? And they look at me like, she's some sort of nutcase. She calls herself an archaeologist, a doctor. Yeah. 9 times out of 10, they say Jerusalem.
Wow.
And I say, no, we're Samaria. Mm-hmm.
But it really is an amazing site.
As far as COVID is concerned, I was there last week, and I know some of the shop owners. I know all the shop owners there, and I know the guys. Restaurants, the local Palestinian guys. And, you know, there's no COVID. The village is small. It's safe. What's going on down in Nablus and the big cities is not good at the moment, but they're COVID free and they're keeping it that way. Mm-hmm. Hoping for tourism. And they, you know, obviously we don't talk politics. They know that they've got a great site there. They are interested in keeping it open, friendly for everybody. So that's the guys who's got a vested interest, because they, you know, they want to sell drinks, they have good facilities, you know, bathrooms, which is very important, let's face
it. Bathrooms, very important, yes. Absolutely. But my dream is that, well, I don't think I'll ever be digging there, but my dream is one day that it be a national park. And that Israel watch it. Yes, I know that it one day be another revert to being a national park with proper paths and signs, and of course protection of the site as we try and do at least in the other parks that have been developed around the country.
Yes,
some kind of laws.
I do feel because it is in a very sensitive area, and because there's a village there and there's local shopkeepers who are trying to make a living there. It will probably have to be a park with a difference, with a certain cooperation, but I think that is totally possible.
Mm-hmm. And that would be for the benefit of everyone.
Absolutely.
And really, mainly for the benefit of the archaeology and for the science and for those of us who love Bible, for those who just read it as an interesting book, whatever it is. This is a site that has hundreds of years, well now, yeah, at least hundreds if not thousands of years of history there, many more things to be discovered, and a really a fascinating glimpse into a little known area and a perhaps a lesser known time. As you said, to the victors go the spoils. Well, the Tanakh is written from the perspective of Judah, of the Judean kingdom.
Yes.
And not as much is written about or known about Israel, about the, that they were open to other cultures because of where they were, and therefore
and they were
more
much
paganism,
larger.
Much larger,
much
probably
larger.
Stronger and wealthier.
Hence more, okay?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot going on there, and there's a whole window into the history that we really just touched.
I totally recommend anybody to go there. And in pre-COVID days, I would go there, and I would see many busloads.
Mm-hmm.
But of tourists, as I say, a lot of Catholic tourists, I would
say. So why is that, Dr. Franklin, just before we end our show, why is it that the Catholics in particular like Shomron?
Well, this is the other story, and that's the story of John the Baptist, which if you read the historian Josephus, he says John the Baptist, if we know who he is, he's the cousin of Jesus of Nazareth.
Right.
If we read Josephus, we're told John the Baptist was murdered by another Herod, and his head was cut off, and it all happened in Macharius, which is a place in southern Jordan. But somehow, somewhere, perhaps in the year 200 AD, perhaps in 300 AD, common era, the story gets placed in Samaria. And they build a church there dedicated to John the Baptist. And that church, if anybody travels to Jordan, it's depicted on a mosaic pavement in a church in Jordan that shows many churches from that
mm-hmm.
time. We know it exists, and we know where it was, which is east of the Forum, at the end of that Decumanus,
right?
Basically just outside the Roman city, because you didn't bury people inside the city.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a tomb there, which has existed definitely and been revered. It's definitely a tomb. I'm not saying who might have been buried there. It's now empty, but
right.
It's definitely a tomb that is revered as being the burial place of the body, not the head.
Not the head, right. They were separated.
The body of
mm-hmm.
John the Baptist. That church was destroyed. It existed from about 330 Common Era to about 600 and something Common Era. It was destroyed in an earthquake, but no one lost sight of the fact that this is the burial place. And we have a lot of pilgrims making pilgrimages to the Holy Land and going to the area. And then along come the Crusaders, and they build a mighty cathedral, the second largest cathedral in the whole of the Holy Land. The largest is in Jerusalem. Say at Sebastia, because that's the name, right? At Sebastia, over the tomb. And then you really get a lot of pilgrims coming to this fantastic cathedral, like one of the wonders of the Christian world. And then comes Salah ad-Din. There's a lot of fighting here, and about 1,200 Crusaders eventually get kicked out. Salah ad-Din doesn't do anything to the cathedral. He reveres it as a place of worship for the Christians. But then along comes his nephew, and his nephew is not so good about it. And the cathedral that existed only for about 200 years, 250 years, is destroyed. It's left as a shell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the village, which was a Christian village, slowly becomes a Muslim village. And there were still, even today, there were two Christian families that live in the village. But basically, inside the big cathedral, what's left of it, the roof has fallen in and everything, there's a small mosque. And people still, the pilgrims go there, and everybody visits it and talks about it and then go up to the tell. So we have wonderful pilgrims' accounts of ancient Samaria and also the Christian period and John the Baptist too. At some point, and I should know this, it's also probably around about 600 and it's later rebuilt by the Crusaders, they discover the head of John the Baptist on the tell. So when you're traveling around the remains of ancient Samaria, you suddenly come across a little church, which is in not in too good a state, that was rebuilt by the Crusaders, and there was a crypt. And in the crypt is where they say they found the head of John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. And that's also the burial ground for the remaining Christian villagers in the village. You'll see a few tombs there. They're Christian tombs. Because that little church of the head was actually a huge monastery. We know that from the texts. And that's never been excellent. So there's so many different stories.
There's so many different layers and stories, one literally right on top of each other in this really fascinating site. Thank you so much, Dr. Norma Franklin. Really, we can go on and on and on.
Yeah, I can talk about it forever, and I'll be happy to go there with you. And I really suggest
love that
everybody visits.
Whenever you get a chance.
Everybody, ancient Israel, Herodian Israel, Roman Israel, and John the Baptist.
Yeah, and we didn't even mention Alexander the Great, but he had a part in it too, but that's going to have to wait for another time.
Exactly.
So thank you so much, Dr. Norma Franklin, really for giving us a little glimpse into some of your work and some of your thoughts on what it is really not a well-known but incredibly important site, the ancient capital of Israel, Shomron, later Sebastia. So thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. And this is Eve Harrow. Take care, everybody. Goodbye for now.
The Land of Israel Network congratulates our own Yishai Fleischer as being listed one of the top 40 global advocates for Israel online by JNS. Yishai Fleischer is the international spokesman for the Jewish community of Hebron and host of the weekly Yishai Fleischer Show, right here on the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com.
Shalom, everybody. This is Jeremy Gimpel from the Land of Israel Network, but also from the Land of Israel Fellowship. We have members from 31 countries joining us every week, Sunday, live at 6 p.m. For those that can't make it live, they get a direct recording. Just go to thelandofisrael.com/fellowship. We're growing together, we're learning together, we're celebrating together. The gates are open for all who want to come and join.